Who's Talking is brought to you by University Square, a collection of locally owned high-end shops and restaurants offering unique products and free storefront parking. Visit University Square on Franklin Street, downtown Chapel Hill. University Square. See you there.
Now, here's D.G. Martin on WCHL.
Welcome to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. We know about Sir Walter Raleigh and the Lost Colony, and we know about how Sir Walter took his cloak off so Queen Elizabeth could get across the mud puddle without getting her feet wet. But who was he really? And as the promotional literature in a new book asks, how can we understand this man who was soldier, voyager, visionary, courtier, politician, poet, historian, patriot, and then in quotes, traitor? The man who knows the answer to all these questions is Mark Nichols, who's the president and librarian of St. John's College at Cambridge University, a guest of the University of North Carolina and East Carolina University, and all the people who in North Carolina who have an interest in who Sir Walter Raleigh really was. And Mark Nichols, thanks for taking time to come and visit with us today.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Who was Sir Walter Raleigh?
Well, he was all those things and more besides. He was just one of these multi-talented, multifaceted individuals that just draw your attention because he's a person who tries to do everything, works hard, has a vision, but is also fallible, is also human. And that's really why I and my co-author, Penry Williams, were attracted to him.
Well, your new book, Sir Walter Raleigh, in Life and Legend. And so let's talk about the legends. I guess every school child in the English-speaking world gets around to hearing the story about Sir Walter Raleigh and his friendship with Queen Elizabeth I and the story about the wonderful story. I mean, they get a great story about this guy who just sees the queen coming and there's a mud puddle and he throws his cloak down and so she walks across it and a friendship blossoms. What a great story.
It's a terrific story. Sadly, it's probably not true.
Oh, probably, you say?
Probably not true.
Well, but you got this probably. Well, almost certainly not true, right?
Well, the story first emerges 20 years after Sir Walter dies, so it comes late. And late evidence, well, you've always got to be careful of it, of course. The element of doubt here, of course, is that it's the sort of way that Sir Walter would have behaved. It's very much in character. The man who has an eye open for the opportunity, an eye for the chance to do something to draw the attention of the Queen. So while there's no evidence that it actually, from contemporary sources, that it happened in the 1580s, there's just a hint that it's the kind of thing that Sir Walter would have done. I like to hang on to it. I don't like these good stories to slip away too easily.
Like our George Washington and the cherry tree sort of story. It may not actually happen, but it's true in the sense that it shows a character and the kind of person about whom the myth or the story is told.
Yes.
Well, your new book, or you're the co-author of this new book about Sir Walter Raleigh. We know him as the man behind the Lost Colony. But even before that, the story is quite interesting, isn't it? All the time from growing up. Give us a little bit of background before this adventure in the New World came about.
Sir Walter comes from a Devon family. He is a Devon man, the southwest of England. And he comes from a well-established family in that part of the world, but they're not top of the tree. They're not in the aristocracy. They're not the traditional elite who absolutely rule England. And Sir Walter, moreover, is a younger son. He's, in fact, the fourth son of his father's fourth son. And that means, of course, that he doesn't inherit the land. He doesn't get the property. That goes to the eldest. So like the other younger sons, like daughters, in a way, you have to go out into the world. You have to make your way in the world. That was the challenge for Sir Walter from day one.
How did one in the time before 1600 find a world to go out and make something of it? What were the opportunities that were open?
Well, what you do have, you don't have an inheritance as such, but you do have family connections. And of course, both Sir Walter's father and his mother were well connected, not only in Devon, but also in London. So he had a list of invitations, if you like, which he could exploit. And he had aunts who worked at the Queen's court and who could give him an introduction to some of the people who were close to the Queen. So Sir Walter has to exploit these opportunities when they arise. He has to take advantage of them and play them for all they're worth.
The chances of any second, third, or fourth sons of a minor aristocratic family making it into court would be, the odds would be against that.
It depends how bright you were, how determined you were, and how assiduous you were at cultivating, at schmoozing, you know, getting on side with the people who counted.
Well, what it would be that you might get invited to visit the court once, and then if people liked you, you'd get another invitation to come back, and then all of a sudden you were. How did that work?
Well, what happened is it's a bit like what the 20th century British diarist once called living on the fringes of power. What you did was you sort of hung around court, out on the edges. You were out on the sort of margins of the circle, and you waited for your opportunity to get a chance to talk to the Queen or to talk to someone very close to the Queen. Sir Walter actually lives in Islington, which is one of the suburbs of London, and he pops to court every now and then and tries to make something of it. And usually, of course, he gets turned away.
Mark, how do you, if I wanted to go to court in England today, I couldn't go and just hang around and wait for the where would you hang around, and how would you hang around, and how would you secure this first invitation to get close to the Queen?
Well, you had to do something to draw yourself to the Queen's attention. That was the key. And of course, what Sir Walter does is he goes off to fight in Ireland.
Ah.
And in Ireland, he gains a reputation for having information on the Irish Wars. He brings that back to the court, and that gives him his chance.
He's got something that nobody else has.
Yep.
If word gets out, this is a fresh look at the Irish situation. It's complicated. We don't know what to do. Here's a young man who's just come back and he's bright. Maybe you'd like to talk to him.
Correct.
That's the
idea.
That's the way you get to talk to the Queen. And then if the Queen likes you, she thinks everything you say is
absolutely
wiser than it might absolutely than
indeed
it might be.
Yes. Sir Walter gets to see the Queen this way. Initially, he gets to talk to her leading counsellors, men like the Earl of Leicester and Sir Francis Walsingham, and they think, yes, this lad's got something. He knows something. He talks sense.
Well, getting back, I only want to spend a minute or two on Ireland, but what was Walter Raleigh doing in Ireland, and how did he get the opportunity to go participate in the goings-on in Ireland during those times?
Well, Ireland was an opportunity for military men at this stage, because one of the leading Irish noblemen was in revolt against the Queen. And, of course, the Queen then needs an army to suppress the revolt. Now, Walter Raleigh uses his connections to secure a captaincy in Ireland. It's an office in the army. It's not a command position, but it's got responsibilities, and it gives him independence and it gives him status. So off he goes. He fights in Ireland, annoying the Lord Deputy, annoying all sorts of people as he does it, because Walter does have a capacity to annoy people, as we'll find out. But what he manages to make of that is, as I say, he manages to position himself so he is the man with the news when he comes back to London.
In Ireland, funny things happening, as you describe in your book, Sir Walter Raleigh in Life and Legend. There's something like a colonization effort going on over there in Ireland, in the sense that Sir Walter also becomes active in how are you going to say this? It's just like population removal and adding new colonies to Ireland.
It's a ruthless approach to an opportunity because, of course, we go back to Sir Walter being a younger son. He doesn't have land. But if you're going to be anyone in Elizabethan England, you need land. You need your own estate to hand on to your heirs. And what he sees in Ireland is a chance to get an estate, to get land. And he's not alone. Lots of his contemporaries see the same opportunity. So the misfortune of the earls who revolt against Elizabeth and who are defeated is someone else's gain because their lands can be redistributed. And in a way, that's what he is, that's his long-term goal.
He becomes the, we would say the owner. He becomes, he has control of the land and he decides to populate it with people from England rather than people from Ireland.
Oh, yes, yes. 40,000 acres he gets, which is a pretty big estate. And, of course, that is not only an opportunity to establish your own status. It's a chance to do favors for other people who are then beholden to you.
Do favors in what respect?
Give them land, give them opportunities.
So you give them some of your land. You're the overlord, but you give them...
Absolutely right, yes, yes. You bring in your own people to settle your land.
So you taught us in your book, describing this experience, where Sir Walter became first acquainted with the idea of colonizing in a different land and becoming a powerhouse by establishing those colonies. We're visiting with Mark Nichols, who's the co-author of a new book on Sir Walter Raleigh, Sir Walter Raleigh and Life and Legend. He and I will be right back after this short break. Who's Talking is brought to you by University Square, a collection of locally owned high-end shops and restaurants offering unique products and free storefront parking. Visit University Square on Franklin Street, downtown Chapel Hill. University Square. See you there.
Now, here's D.G. Martin on WCHL.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin, and I'm visiting with the co-author of a brand new book about Sir Walter Raleigh, guy for whom Raleigh was named, the guy who was responsible for the colonizing efforts on our coast, now known as the Lost Colony. The book is Sir Walter Raleigh in Life and Legend. And Mark Nichols, thanks for coming to talk with us about Sir
Thank
Walter
you.
Raleigh.
Thank you.
Well, sir, you told us about how Sir Walter Raleigh became an insider in court, and you've talked about how he gained experience in colonization by virtue of that experience in Ireland. Now, how did all this come together to have an impact on the early history of North Carolina's coastline?
Two roots to this. First of all, there is Sir Walter's need for land. As a younger son, he needs the estate. He needs to have his own property. And casting his eye across the Atlantic, well, there's a chance not only to get thousands of acres, as he does in Ireland, there's a chance to get millions of acres, vast new territories carved out of the New World. There's more to it, though, than that, because there's also a family involvement. His half-brother, Humphrey Gilbert, is a pioneer of colonization, of westward expansion. Humphrey Gilbert drowns in 1583 on an Atlantic voyage. And of course, that opens an opportunity for someone else to move in and to pick up the torch where Gilbert drops it. And Sir Walter takes that opportunity. He assembles a really skillful team of advisors, of people who know what there is to be known about this unexplored land, and begins to put together an operation that will possibly lead to some permanent colony.
There are several problems or challenges that this kind of promoter would have, and they were such vast problems that they would have scared me away. One is that you have to get authority. You have to get some sort of governmental authority to cast about. And that's not always an easy thing to do, given the commitments that might have to go along with that from the government. And the other is somebody's got to pay for it. Mm. So how does he how does he get the authority, and where does he get the money to get into this kind of venture?
Well, for the authority, of course, he's in a good position because he has got Elizabeth's support and attention. He is the favorite of the Queen. People know that he can talk to the Queen, that the Queen listens to him. They respect him, and therefore they're much more likely to support him if he comes forward with this kind of idea. Money is tricky because, as you say, this is an expensive, a risky venture. The other side of the Atlantic in those days is at the end of a 6 weeks to 3 months supply line. You know, you can set off. Your ships need not ever get there. They can be diverted. They can be blown away by storms. All sorts of things can go wrong. But what, again, Sir Walter does is he trades on his name and reputation, and he gets, just as you would today, he gets city money to back him.
He gets what kind of money?
He gets money from the City of London to back him.
How does that work?
Well, he comes to people with money, financiers in the city, and he says, invest with me. This is what I'm trying to do. If it all goes right, the returns are going to be spectacular. Of course, it's risky, but it's worth a shot.
How does he describe the possible returns from a adventure in a land that seems very nice looking, but doesn't hold a particular promise for gold or for manufacturing or for any sort of real agriculture? How do you get a quick payoff to pay back your investors?
The great advantage is, no one really knows what's over there. They know the coastline, the shape of the coastline. But beyond that, well, the whole place is terra incognita. So who knows what's out there? In terms of latitude, of course, this is good farming country. You can theoretically, if it's like Europe, you can grow all sorts of things. So by casting your eye across the Atlantic, it's another opportunity state, really. It's a gamble. Everyone knows it's a gamble. Everyone accepts that this thing can all go horribly wrong.
Well, now, one of the shockers in your book, Sir Walter Raleigh in Life and Legend. Well, let me see how I'm going to introduce the topic. We're talking about making money and how you provide a return to your investors. And the little word piracy crept in, or maybe not quite piracy, but was there money to be made off the North Carolina coast?
Well, there was money.
Stealing from other people, taking other people's property.
Well, there was money to be made not that far away. Yeah, they dressed this up. They didn't call it piracy. They called it privateering. Basically, this was piracy by license. You went to the Queen and said, "Can I plunder your enemies for you, ma'am?" And she said, "Yes, go ahead." So you got a letter of authority, and you went off, and you sought to capture enemy ships and make a profit for yourself.
Enemy commercial ships or gold-carrying ships, these kinds of,
the Spanish Empire.
It's hard for us to put this in context, particularly since we're fighting pirates off the Somali coast right now and think it's a bad thing. But in England, it edged towards a little bit unseemly activity, but basically it was you were doing a good thing for the country and you were doing all right for yourself if you were able to bring a gold-laden ship back to England.
You were. Both sides, of course, did this. This was a way of carrying on a war against your enemy, and you would be foolish not to.
Just go ahead. Because it has a lot to do with the history of North Carolina later on, what was the situation militarily or diplomatically with England and other countries in Europe at this stage of the game?
England in the 1580s is sliding towards open war with Spain, the greatest, foremost power in Europe. It's powerful because, not least, because of its empire in Central and South America and its sources of silver, which it gets from Peru. And England wants a slice of that, of course. As well as being at war with Spain, it would like to deprive Spain of some of its sources of profit. That's the driving force. There's a religious element in here. Spain is a Catholic power. England, of course, is newly Protestant under Queen Elizabeth I. And so both sides view this not only as a straightforward war of aggression and survival, they see other factors such as religious identity wrapped up in the struggle.
Well, as Sir Walter Raleigh gets started, and this privateering that you talk about is underway, but the countries are not really in down and dirty war. This is sort of a halfway war.
From 1585, it's the real thing. From that point onwards, the gloves are off.
Wow. Well, we're visiting with Mark Nichols about, who is the co-author of a new book on Sir Walter Raleigh, Sir Walter Raleigh in Life and Legend, and he and I will be right back.
Who's Talking is brought to you by University Square, a collection of locally owned high-end shops and restaurants offering unique products and free storefront parking. Visit University Square on Franklin Street, downtown Chapel Hill. University Square, see you there.
Now, here's D.G. Martin on WCHL.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. Our visitor is Mark Nichols, who's the president and librarian of St. John's College and Cambridge University in England. He's over here to talk about someone in whom we have a common interest, Sir Walter Raleigh. The book is Sir Walter Raleigh in Life and Legend. And Mark Nichols, thanks again for coming to visit with us about him.
Thank you.
You've given us some great background. I just have to say that there's so much more. You'll have to read the book about early Sir Walter Raleigh. But those of us in North Carolina, of course, want to learn all we can about what happened on our coastline in the adventure called the Lost Colony. And would you tell us the story from the perspective of the biographer of Sir Walter Raleigh? Was the Roanoke Island expedition, was that an important part, all told, of Sir Walter Raleigh's experience, or was that just a little sideline?
It was a very important phase in his life at the time. At this point in his career, he is trying to establish himself. He's gained the ear of the Queen. He's become a significant figure at the court of Queen Elizabeth I. But what he now wants to do is to take this a stage further. He wants to get land, status, credibility for himself, and he wants to do something for his mistress. He wants to do something for Queen Elizabeth. And all these factors come together in the opportunity to create something totally new across the Atlantic, permanent English colonies in the New World.
So is he the originator of this kind of more than just sort of going and fishing and pirateering and trading to go and have a land-based colony in North America?
Ideas for colonies have been kicking around for a long time. Trouble is, you've got to sort of peel them away and see what is meant by a colony. Is it simply a military base full of men without women and children? Or is it a colony which is going to be commercial, which is going to be civilian, which is going to put down roots over the very long term? And what's interesting about Sir Walter is first that he assembles such a good team to make this a reality, and secondly that in his own experience his thinking moves from the first model of a colony, which is the military base, to the second model of a colony, which is the civilian base. And of course he attempts a colony twice, and of course it's the second colony, which is the Lost Colony, and that is the civilian model.
And your book has led me, you may not have meant to lead me there, but your book has led me to think that Sir Walter's Irish experience in moving people into a strange land and figuring out how to make that venture profitable through an agricultural and then minor support network for that, that you made me believe that he sort of developed that idea and a belief that that could happen through that experience.
Yes, these are two sides to the same coin with Sir Walter. In fact, what he does is once he gets hold of a lot of land in Ireland, he tends to lose interest in the New World because, of course, that's further away, that's much more risky. Ireland is closer to home. You can probably stand more chance of making it pay in the shorter term. But in terms of ideas, you're quite right. He draws on the ideas for colonization in Ireland and says, well, let's try this further afield. Let's try this over the Atlantic.
What was his plan? What do you find out about? We know what happened. What was his plan for the North American colony?
Well, that's precisely difficult to say because it does evolve over time. Initially, his plan seems to be, well, let's get at the Spanish Empire. Let's set up a base here that can really make a nuisance of itself to Spain.
Military type thing.
That's the first attempt at a colony. It's essentially a military staging post. But the Lost Colony, the second attempt, well, that's different. He's clearly trying to send people out, and he has a propaganda team, a spin team at work who are saying, you know, there's all sorts of chances out there. This is a land flowing with milk and honey, so, you know, go out there and make something of it. And that gets together a mixed group of people who say, okay, I'm up for the gamble. I'll give it a try. And that's what Sir Walter wants. He wants to see these people going out in his name, in the Queen's name, and winning glory for both of them.
The idea then, I don't want to push this too hard, but the idea initially is that we'll have more than a military crew, we'll have families there, mm-hmm. and they will set up a farming operation mm-hmm. or a mining operation or a trading group. How is that going to work in his mind over the long term?
There's the question. Almost certainly an element of all those, because Sir Walter was not a man to close a door on any good idea. And let's face it, if you're trying to sell this to sometimes skeptical people back in England, you might as well say there's farming opportunities here, there's commercial opportunities here, there's every sort of opportunity. You can go out digging for gold if that's what you want to do. Whet their appetites. Get them on the ship and off. That's what you've got to do. Then the reality can sink in once they're across the Atlantic.
Well, as you described so well, it didn't work out. And we know some of that story from our history books and as children in North Carolina. Who's Talking is brought to you by University Square, a collection of locally owned high-end shops and restaurants offering unique products and free storefront parking. Visit University Square on Franklin Street, downtown Chapel Hill. University Square. See you there.
Now, here's D.G. Martin on WCHL.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. We're visiting with Mark Nichols. Mark is the president and librarian of St. John's College at Cambridge University. Part of Cambridge University in England, and he is the co-author of Sir Walter Raleigh in Life and Legend. He's visiting in America to tell those of us who are so used to talking about Sir Walter Raleigh that we want some more information. And some of what you're telling us we like, some of it we're not too excited about. And one of the sort of scandals that's circling around your book is that that Sir Walter Raleigh was a traitor to England. And we know that he ultimately lost favor with Queen Elizabeth for a little while, and then when the new king came, he lost favor entirely and ultimately lost his life as the result. Was he really a traitor, and what really happened?
Technically, yes, he was. You have to remember it's quite easy to commit treason. You can commit treason by words.
That's back in those days.
Well, technically, you can still
do that.
Yes,
is that right?
Yes. What happens here is all tied up with the change of ruler. When Elizabeth I dies in 1603, as you say, England gets a new king. He's King James VI of Scotland. So a Scottish king becomes King of England. Now, James disagrees with a lot that Sir Walter has stood for. Sir Walter advocates continued war against Catholic Spain. James doesn't want that. James wants peace with Spain. He looks at the bill for war and thinks, goodness, this is way too expensive. I don't want to waste money on that. His mind has also been poisoned by letters that he's been receiving from Sir Walter's rivals at the English court saying, you've got to watch out for Sir Walter. You can't trust him. He's not in support of your policies. So James comes with his mind prejudiced. And at once he takes Sir Walter's, all his perks, his gifts that he's received from Elizabeth, he takes them all away. He takes his house away. He takes his title as captain of the Queen's bodyguard away. He takes away a lot of his income. Now, of course, this makes Sir Walter very cross indeed. A wise politician, though, would ride the blow, would simply wait on a chance for better times. Sir Walter, though, can never quite keep his mouth shut. He goes off and expresses his discontent to a friend. He says, I'm really fed up with this situation. And let's think about what might happen here. Wouldn't it be better if instead of having this Scottish king, we had someone else on the throne? And to do that, wouldn't it be a good idea to get an army? Well, what about the Spanish army? We could get them to land at Milford Haven over in Wales, a good harbour. They could march to London from there. He's really just expressing his anger and his frustration. But the fact that he's done that makes him a traitor.
And how does that how does that come to light? And then how is it? What kind of trial does he have? And what happens?
It comes to light because he chooses the wrong man to express this discontent to. His friend Lord Cobham is wrapped up in another treason against James. They were coming thick and fast in those days, and he is arrested on suspicion of that treason, and then tells his investigators, his interrogators, about this conversation he's had with Sir Walter. And that, of course, starts the process against Walter Raleigh.
This is a great story in your book, and ultimately Sir Walter is tried and convicted and sentenced to death, to beheading. And this is not long after King James comes on the throne, but it's many years later before the sentence is before Sir Walter really loses his life. In the meantime, he's up there writing histories of the world and having the most comfortable imprisonment that you can imagine. How did it work back then?
Well, the first thing to say, I think, is that Sir Walter always shows best when the odds are stacked against him. Although he is indeed he's found guilty and sentenced to death at his trial, he wins everyone's sympathy.
Why?
He conducts himself so well. Everyone sees that this is very harsh, that all he's done is mutter and grumble, and that it's very, very severe to take someone to court for doing that. And he behaves impeccably at the trial. He shows himself honourable, modest, respectful of the court. But he keeps pointing out that to the English jury that if they do find him guilty of this crime, who is safe? Who is actually sure that they won't be the next person on the list? And that resonates.
Yeah, nevertheless, he's found guilty and he's sentenced. And why didn't they go ahead and chop his head off?
Because James is still in his first year as king, and he doesn't want to shed too much blood. It starts the reign off in a bad way. So he spares Sir Walter's life, but he leaves him to rot in the Tower. And as you say, Sir Walter is a man of energy. He never sits still. So he's cooped up in the Tower, comfortable quarters. If you've got money to pay, that's okay. And he uses his time to good effect. Yes, he knocks off a history of the world, 1 million words of it. And, it takes the story right through to about 150 BC. And then he gets bored and he moves on to something else. But this is just the way he is.
Well, one very quickly, not only does he work in prison, but he gets himself out of prison just before he gets his head chopped off and goes and starts another colony or attempts a colonization effort.
It's not colony. No, it's not a colony. He's after gold. He's got out of the Tower of London by essentially whetting the king's appetite that you might get some gold out of a gold mine on the Orinoco River. So he sails off to South America. It's a disaster. He finds no gold, no silver.
Well, let me just interrupt you, even though we got... He gets out of jail, out of the death sin. He gets out of the next door to the... Yep. And persuades the king to let him have one last chance before he gets his head chopped off, and he takes it, and he gets out.
Well, the king needs money. And the king has no intention of cutting Sir Walter's head off at that point. He's just going to, as I say, let him rot in the tower. But he thinks, well, this is probably worth a throw. If Sir Walter can find gold and silver, I get a lot of money. If he doesn't, I can throw him to the wolves.
Well,
and of course, that's what happens.
And throw to the wolves he did. Much more to the story, all of which is in the new book, Sir Walter Raleigh and Life and Legend. The co-author is Mark Nichols, and he's given us a great introduction to the story of the man for whom we've named our state capital. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, thanks to Mark Nichols. Thanks all y'all for listening. This is D.G. Martin, and Who's Talking, and we'll be right back here soon.